Welcome back to the History of Rock podcast. His name is Brandon. He's the DJ.
His name is Shim. He is the rock star. Class is in session. We're going part two, baby, on Limp Bizkit, chocolate starfish, and the hot dog flavored water. I do have to say that the upcoming episodes as well are going to be a ridiculous amount of fun to record. Hopefully people have just as much fun listening and or watching the episodes, because we're going to get into Ozfest. And we'll cover Ozfest. So Ozfest started as like the flip of what Lollapalooza was. Lollapalooza started as the tour and then ended up becoming a weekend thing. Ozfest started as a weekend thing and then it flipped into a major tour. There was an unreleased documentary. I think the official name was We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll. It was about the 99 Ozfest. You had Static X was on there. Godsmack was on there. Just major acts now. But at that time, these were not known bands, really. And this documentary's great. I'm only like halfway through it. And what takes so much time is I'll watch the documentary, and then I got to type out what I watched. And then I got to watch more, and then I got to type out, and then I got to go back, and I got to type out some more. So that's what's been so consuming with this Ozfest stuff. But I'm telling you, it's going to be a ton of fun. But for this episode, we're talking Limp Bizkit, Chocolate Starfish, and Hot Dog Flavored Water, the album released October 17th of the year 2000. When I do that, and does that even mean anything to you?
2000? When you go 2000? No. I don't know what that is.
It was a Conan O'Brien bit that he used to do.
That definitely didn't make it here.
It was a bit that he would do leading up to the year 2000, where they would make these really silly and stupid predictions that were hilarious, and it would always just go, in the year 2000, and then he would read something that would come in there. And then when the year 2000 hit, they actually just kind of kept the bit going.
Really?
Oh, it was great.
That's funny, because that was going to be my first question. Was going to be, well, once now that you do that, 20 years later, 22 years later, you sound like, we feel like old men being like, any person who's 21 right now is like, what about it? It was fucking ages ago.
That was, what the hell's going on there?
But I'm looking forward to hearing about this. This is something we're getting into the part two of Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water with Limp Bizkit. Durst has said he is a big fan of Nine Inch Nails, but Trent Reznor had made negative comments about Durst during that period. The lyrics come off as an attack on Reznor, and we are, of course, talking about the opening track.
Hot Dog! That's the one that, like we said in the last episode, it says fuck 46 times in it, and it also uses lyrics from Nine Inch Nails songs like Closer, The Perfect Drug, and Burn. It comes off like a rip on Reznor, because he's like, you wanna fuck me like an animal, like he's like almost attacking Trent Reznor. But Durst has said that it like he's a big fan of Nine Inch Nails. Yes, Trent Reznor had said some negative comments about Limp Bizkit, but because Durst used so many lyrics from Nine Inch Nails songs, Reznor actually got a co-writer credit on that song, and he approved it as the record was getting ready to print, because he didn't want to hold up the release. Like that kind of
Reznor didn't want to hold up the release?
He did not.
Durst.
No, Reznor.
Holy shit. That is really genuinely fascinating. I could have sworn everyone, that's really good research, because I can imagine everyone else watching who knows about this stuff would have gone like, yeah, it's a dig, and he put it in there, and Trent Reznor was all butthurt. He knew about it beforehand and cleared it as not to hold up Limp Bizkit's release.
Yeah. Like how
that's dope.
How gangster's that of Trent Reznor, man?
That really is. So, but let me ask, in your research, did you find out, did Trent and Fred Durst ever have a conversation about it? Was there a bridge that was built, or did was just managers went and he said, yeah, whatever, approve it, give me 50%, fuck it?
I wasn't able to find any of that. So if anybody out there does, you can hit us up on the socials, or if you're here on YouTube, whether you're on Shim's channel or my channel, please comment below and link to it. This is one of the things I'm having problems with. When a lot of the kind of did you know videos that I'm doing on social media now is people will be like, well, that's not true. That's bullshit. It's this. Or I knew a guy that said this. Look, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I have no problems being wrong. I do research these, but that doesn't mean I'm infallible. Like, I can still make a mistake. And if I do, you can call me out. I don't even care if you do it rudely or not. Like, I don't give a shit.
But you just want to link.
Link your fucking source. Look, right here. Give a fucking link. Because that's the one thing that people keep doing. Like, there was one with one of the most recent ones was about Nickelback and kind of the origins and how Mike Krueger worked at Starbucks. Every version of the story I always heard was that he worked at Starbucks and he would say, here's your Nickelback. And that's how the band got their name. And there's been a lot of people who are like, well, there was no Starbucks in their hometown, so he didn't work at a Starbucks. And I'm like, okay. I've looked up at least a dozen sources that have said that it was a Starbucks. They all could be wrong. I'm not saying that they're not. But if you know it's wrong,
I'm saying they're right, and that commenter is full of shit. Brandon's not saying it. I am.
But I have no problems being wrong, but link an actual reputable source to the fucking thing. Like, that's all I'm saying. Oh, because one guy commented, my brother knew a guy that was friends with one of their dog walkers, and he said that's not true. Like, I mean, I exaggerated that, but that's basically what
I was
going to
say. That sounds like an exaggeration.
Yeah, and I exaggerated the comment, but I'm like, you gotta come with something a little stronger than that, man.
So then... I've totally lost the track of the question that I was going to... No. The thing that I was going to say is, last point before we go to the next point, doesn't that just tell you what a businessman Trent Reznor is to say, I don't give a fuck what some red hat Southern hick rapper says about me. Give me my money and fuck off. Approve it so I can get paid. They're the biggest band in the world. Give me my money. And he would have made good money off that. 50%. Of a fucking Limp Bizkit song in perpetuity because he wants to take a pot shot and you're like, yeah, take them all. Send the check on the way.
Yeah.
That's gangster. That's a fucking move.
I mean, you're assuming that he did it just for money. Is there any part of you that assumes that maybe he did it? Be like, yeah, look, like I may have said some shitty things about them, but they're still artists and I don't want to hold their shit up.
No, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think he said some shit. I think whatever happened, he looked at the biggest band in the world, wanted to take a shot, and he took the high road and got paid all the way. That's what I think happened. And that's going to be a great clip. So coming back to it, the track, this was my favorite track off the record, by the way. The track, Living It Up, samples the Eagles, Life in the Fast Lane. Now, you got something here. Am I supposed to say this?
No, this is for me. So I saw an interview with Wes Borland, and the interview was from, I believe, around 2008, 2009, and they were talking about how they sampled the Eagles, and this is the first time anyone had sampled the Eagles. I'm not sure if there was something more to that story or if there was maybe something specific that he was referencing that made it different, but it was not. This is not the first time, and it's not the only time anybody has sampled the Eagles. There's been tons of songs that have sampled the Eagles.
Did they get in trouble for it? Was it a thing where they didn't declare?
No, they got approved.
And then the Eagles
approved. Yeah. Now, my only thing is, it might have been the first time somebody was approved, because if you remember back in the 80s, you didn't have to get shit for approval. You could just do the song. I mean, go back and listen to Beastie Boys' "License to Ill." Half that album, it's Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. And you know, they didn't have to go to Robert Plant or Jimmy Page or anybody from Led Zeppelin to get the approval. Yeah. You could just put it on the album. And then that changed later on down the road, right?
Yeah.
I did a version of In Vogue.
Was it Destiny's Child?
That's it.
Destiny's Child. Yeah. For anyone that
Because you guys weren't allowed to release that, right?
No, it was one of the 17 writers on the Destiny's Child song "Say My Name" was a devout Christian evangelist and said that because we said "Say My Name, bitch" before the drop, that it went against the original sensibilities of the song and he would not approve it. That was in writing, and so we were sent a letter that said, you are not allowed to release this and you must burn and destroy all copies of the master, because if it even gets leaked, which of course it eventually did. I don't know by who. It could be, there'd be backlash. So we sent a picture of ourselves setting fire to a CD and sent it to him. But no, it's like,
okay,
stupid.
So you're one of the 17 writers. Which part did you come up with? The say, the my, or the name part?
Yeah, exactly.
Say my name.
Yeah, I remember even everyone in Australia, because it was in the papers and stuff when it happened, because we released it anyway. We were like, the song's banned. Here, check it out. It was great for advertising. But we put it out and we were like, no one in Australia could believe that those songs had 17 writers, because they didn't put credits on albums for the other people at the time. Usually you had to dig deep to find shit like that. It was not online like it is now. No one could believe 17. We were like, well, we figured it was like five, the girls in the band, a couple of producers, a writer. No, 17. Like, God damn, everyone's getting paid except the fucking artist. Anyway, this is yours. I got a point about this. Go ahead.
The song Get Your Groove On, speaking of like uncredited sampling, it used an uncredited sample of music that is played during an aerial trapeze act on Cirque du Soleil's, I'll say reinvent, but it's French, so it's like reinvente or whatever the fuck you want to call it.
Reinvente.
So Wes reinvente. Borland said, quote, we actually got sued over this piece of shit. There was some sort of sample used in that someone didn't get full clearance for, so we ended up getting into some serious trouble for a little while. And then while the track made it, when the track finally made it to streaming services, because that was on the main album. And I remember this was something that always confused the hell out of me, because when you go stream the song now, Get Your Groove On, it's the remix version from their album New Old Songs, where they just basically took their hits and a lot of their songs, and then they just they're remix versions of it, and that's the version of Get Your Groove On that's on streaming services.
So that means that if you have the album, you can hear the original version.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's fascinating.
It didn't magically change when streaming services came out. Like your CD didn't change.
No, I didn't. No, I wouldn't have occurred to me. But I love the fact. And this goes to my point. I haven't read this, by the way, guys. The song Get Your Groove On. Wes Borland was quoted as saying, we actually got sued over that piece of shit, which tells me that maybe he wasn't a fan of that song, because I know I wasn't. I always thought that
like
was
X
like
to the
diet.
Z exhibit? You don't want him to pimp your ride?
No, I thought it was like Diet Pepsi together. It was like they needed to have a rap song with real rappers on it. And it was such a big hit off Significant Other. They were like, oh, the record's done. Oh, wait, we don't have that fourth single with a rapper. Oh, I'm freezing. I'm glitching. Can you? Yeah, it's all right.
I can still hear you.
For everyone. Yeah, it's all right. It doesn't matter. No one cares about my.
You know what that was? That was Exhibit fucking with your internet connection. He's pissed.
Oh, I'm terrified, mate. I'm terrified. actually, I should be terrified of Exhibit. He's like kill people. So says the whitest of white men in the world.
No, he just wants to pimp your ride.
I thought that fucking song sucked. I always thought that song was just. Real. I skipped it every time, every fucking time. I never listened to it. But anyway, that was me.
I mean, it obviously it wasn't held up in high regard for me, at least as much as In Together Now, because In Together Now was Method Man, who's one of my favorite rappers of all time.
Yeah, and his raps were amazing on that song.
Yeah, and and it almost felt like it was a reason to take Exhibit on tour with them for the Anger Management tour, because I know that Exhibit ended up on that tour as well. Which we're going to get to here in a little bit. But quick side note, by the way. Have you ever heard the horror stories of the people who were on Pimp My Ride?
No. Go ahead.
But you're familiar with Pimp My Ride, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
People show up with this piece of shit, and then they you know, make it into this, like, TVs coming out of the back and all this kind of crap. And they would be like, yeah, remember like that popcorn maker they put in the back? Yeah, they took that back. Like, that wasn't given to me. And you remember all this stuff that was put on here? Yeah, they took that back too. Like, it wasn't given. Like, it was what that final product of the car, that was not the final product of the car the person got to drive away in, because half of that shit was still owned by the production team.
Really? So they go to all the effort to put it in there, and then they just gut it and hand the car back.
Pretty much. Now, it's not to say that the car went back to the way that it was. It's just... I've read multiple horror stories from people that were on that show that were like, yeah, it's not exactly how it comes out. See, it's like, it's weird when you look into reality shows. Like, have you ever watched any of those shows where people go to, like, let's say Chip and Joanna Gaines, and they're like, we're going to go look at three different houses. You're going to give us like options of what we can do with each house, and then we're going to pick one, and that's the one you guys are going to make all fancy for us. Like, something like that.
Yeah.
The two people, or the person, whoever the hell it is buying the house, they have to buy, they like the house is already, I believe, I don't think it's pre-purchased, but they're already saying like, that's the house I'm going with. But then they have to go find two comparable houses on their own to figure out which ones they're going to like compare to this third one that's already been chosen by them because it's a house they've already essentially bought.
Yeah.
Like it's a...
No, it's... There was...
I still love Jim and Joanna Gaines though. Sorry.
Over a decade ago, there was a mass writer's strike. There was a mass writer's strike in Hollywood over a decade ago because writers quit across the board. Every single writer in Hollywood quit because reality TV show writers were not getting paid. Mm-hmm. They weren't getting credited or paid. They were like, and for a year, there were no writers in Hollywood, shut down all production. And what happened is this was the thing that threw gasoline on the fire for reality TV. Everyone should think to themselves, oh, it's not reality TV. They have writers. Yeah. It's the same as regular TV. They just hire shitty actors to pretend to be surprised and tell them there's going to be a midget that runs through naked. Pretend to be surprised. We're cleared. It's got insurance. But people write this shit. And because they striked, the people who produce the shows as a fuck you said, well, we don't need you anyway. It's reality. We could do anything and it'll still sell on TV. So they wrote the worst reality shows. They were hits. And then reality exploded into this fucking orgy of horror that it is now because there was no writers to say, no, well, this would actually be a better storyline. It was like, nah, story's out the window. Just shock them for 20 minutes, throw the ads in, fuck off. That's it. So for anyone that thinks that reality is real, it ain't. Meta. Going back to Limp Bizkit.
Hold on. Because you just gave me an idea. For the upcoming Remix episode, the discussion topic, I want to bring up the worst of the worst reality shows.
Oh,
like,
please.
There was like Joe Millionaire, where they like lied to all these girls that this dude was a millionaire when he really wasn't. Like there's
That show should have been called Bitches Be Whores.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that doesn't hit the Billboard quite as nicely as the other ones do.
But that's all it was. It was every single woman that was like, as soon as they found out that it was Joe Dirt. Joe Millionaire. As soon as they found out he wasn't rich and they all changed. And it was like, oh, that's all. Don't get me wrong. By the way, I want to clarify. I'm not saying that bitches be whores. I'm saying they found a bunch of women who were like that, put them all on a show and lied to them for the whole season. And then like they shouldn't have called it. It wasn't about the dude. It was about making these women who were just already terrible people be the worst versions of themselves.
Yeah.
Fucking A.
They wanted screen time. By the way, real quick note too. So the writer strike, I believe it was 2008. When the writer's strike happened.
That's when the world fell apart.
There was really one show that survived it and flourished as far as an audience goes.
Right.
And it was Big Bang Theory. Because Big Bang Theory had just come out. And then the writer's strike hit. And all of a sudden they were like, oh shit, we really don't have any episodes. Because this was a time when I actually watched network television, which I'd never really done a lot of. And this was like The Simpsons or Friends or something like that. Yeah. And so Big Bang Theory, I got into it because it was right up my alley. It's nerd shit. And there was another show called Life that starred Damian Lewis, which I loved. That one, they tried so hard to get it to survive post-writer strike, and they just couldn't get it going. But yeah, Big Bang
Theory. So who was writing The Big Bang Theory?
Well, Big Bang Theory came from Chuck Lorre. He was the guy behind Two and a Half Men and a lot of like other just massively successful shows. So whatever they were able to do, they were able to kind of ride the wave, and it went off during the writer's strike, and then they brought it back, and they were able to survive. Nice. And it went on to become one of the biggest television shows in history.
Good for
that. But now we're going to go back to the albums in rock history.
And this is the good old days. Talking about the good old days, the album sold more than 1 million copies in its first week, with more than 400,000 copies sold on the first day. It was the largest first week sales for a rock album in the US since Nielsen SoundScan began tracking album sales in 1991. That's a big deal.
That's a really big fucking deal. So this was the fourth highest album in 2000 behind Eminem's Marshall Mathers LP. This one's for my wife. NSYNC's No Strings Attached. Because that was all she was about, man. And Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again.
Those were the good old days. Dude, those charts were the best. When all those bands were rocking, doing their thing, it was a great time to be in music.
really.
Back to me. The album ended up, you don't think so? Fuck it. The album ended up being certified 4 times platinum 2 months after its release. That's pretty good. It's so good, in fact, that I have just stopped speaking. My entire face, it can't move. I'm stuck in a convulsion because that is such shocking information. 5 times
all the
platinum,
people who are only listening to this on Apple after have no fucking clue what you're talking about.
It's all right. By 2002, it had gone 6 times platinum. That's pretty good. Well, 1, 2, 3 times 2 to the 6.
That's not bad. Not too shabby. So Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water. So this is a big album. If you had to pick between this one and Significant Other, which one are you taking?
Chosen for your fix of the Limp Bizkit mix. How could you leave me hanging?
I didn't hear you.
You didn't pick it up? No. 1, 2, 3 times 2 to the 6. Chosen it's for your fix of the Limp Bizkit mix.
You're getting glitchy.
For really? Oh, well, maybe we're not going to be able to make it. Chocolate Starfish. Okay, let me pick up where you picked up. I'll drop in. Go ahead. Say it again.
Okay, so Chocolate Starfish or Significant Other. If you can pick one of those two.
Significant Other, by far.
That's kind of what I figured. I think that would be the one I would go with as well. But as far as the reviews go, it was met with some mixed reviews. AllMusic writer Stephen Thomas Erlewine, he wrote, Durst's self-pitying and the monotonous music giveaway that the band bashed Chocolate Starfish out very quickly. It's the sound of a band determined to deliver a sequel in a finite amount of time.
That's a fair assessment. That sounds exactly like what it is.
Does that connect the with rolling? You?
Yeah, totally. That, oh, fuck. The only difference between that is that we took too long to release that fucking record. The album was subpar for the opposite reason. Oh,
there's so many people, there's so many members of the Hollywood Rebellion that have known you that they get that. They understand that joke.
Yeah. The Rolling Stone album Guide awarded the album 3 out of 5 stars, whereas the magazine itself gave the album a 3.5 out of 5.
So it's not terrible, but I mean, it's still, I mean, there's great songs on this album. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'll listen to Roland and My Generation and stuff like that, but just front to back, Significant Other was so good. Now,
but you can hear in his lyrics when he said 1, 2, 3 times 2 to the 6, like all of Roland. All of the lyrics for Roland are literally just like, Fred, you got to say something. You got to say something. It's a verse. Can you just say something? And he's like, 1, 2, 3 times 2 to the 6.
What rhymes with 6? Mix.
So where the fuck you at? Back the fuck up. Now, shut the fuck up while we fuck this shit up. I'm like, it says nothing. It's so nothing. And yet it was the biggest hit song of the fucking year because it just drops like a bitch.
So this next these next parts here where we wrap this up, we're going to be covering MTV did a 20 years of rock program, and then we're going to wrap things up with the feud between Limp Bizkit and Eminem.
Yes.
But during the MTV 20 years of rock program, so I think this would have come out early 2000s, they talk about music in that moment. They mentioned that Kid Rock taking over for the David Lee Roth role, I guess, is like the loudmouth, long-haired sort of... I'm not really sure what they meant by that, but that's what they said.
Yeah.
And they also say that you can track... They specifically say you can track the rap rock genre all the way back to Faith No More's Epic.
Would you agree with that?
I think... I got to look at the dates, but... I would go back to when Run DMC remixed Walk This Way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The only difference might be that Run DMC, it was a cover.
True. But I think that's a lot of where people learn, like, oh, rap and rock can go together.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, actually. That is fair. And Run DMC were definitely the first to put that type of thing together. But Faith No More was how far before Rage Against the Machine's first album? Was Epic.
Epic came out. Well, first of all, so yeah, the Run DMC thing, that was way before. That was that was released in 86. For some reason, I was thinking that was a little bit later. No, it was 86. And then Faith No More. Epic, what is it?
Check it out.
91.
Yeah. 91,
which was the same
so
year
yeah.
that Rage released their first album in 91.
Yeah, so Rage was doing it before the song Epic dropped. But yeah. I still think Rage is the best. Anyway, Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day said, I love this, the new metal rap thing completely sucks ass. I don't get it, and I don't want to get it, and I don't really mind if I don't get it.
Yeah, like they're cutting through all of these different artists, sort of, what do you think of this new thing where they're mixing rap and rock together? And he was just like, he's like, I think it sucks ass. I don't get it. I don't care if I don't get it. Like, he almost comes off like he is upset he was asked that question and he has to waste breath on answering a question about rap rock.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So artists who said that they liked it, though, because it kind of shows different genres mixing together, were Alanis Morissette, Billy Corgan, and our good buddy Perry Farrell.
Perry Farrell. And I think it actually, Limp Bizkit are, this is why it's interesting, Limp Bizkit are starting to get some of the credit that they deserve in a way, because they're becoming a legacy act. Because rap rock finally has started to become reincorporated in modern heavy rock. There's a lot of hip hop elements, there's a lot of rap that's coming into it. And it's being done well. You know, not to say that Limp Bizkit didn't do it well, but there were a lot of bands that didn't do it well for a while. And now it's coming back in. And that fusion, that concept of fusing hip-hop and trance and electronic elements and really heavy riffs and screamo with great melodies, all that stuff is, you know, it's kind of stems from the Bizkit in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Family Values Tour. The Family Values Tour took a year off in 2000 because the Anger Management Tour took over that year with Limp Bizkit, Eminem, and Papa Roach.
Yeah, I went to that, and it was amazing. And my note here is actually a little bit off because I kept getting these confused. I had not started working in radio yet in the year 2000. I didn't start until 2001. It was actually, you know, because as we're filming this here in the beginning of September or the middle of September, I started radio right after 9/11 happened. So that was 2001. And so in the year 2000, I remember I went to that show. It was awesome. It was an amazing concert. And then in 2002, when it came back, I believe it was Eminem. It was Eminem, Papa Roach, Ludacris, Exhibit. There's your Get Your Groove On. The Executioners and Bionic Jive. They were the ones that came into town. And this is when I was working at the radio station. And I remember we did this thing where we were... I interned for KNRK, which was an alternative rock station. There was like a hip hop station in town called Jammin 95.5. And then there was another more album rock station called KUFO. That one that Al Scott worked for that did the whole Limp Bizkit counterfeit thing. So I remember, though, we were up on stage out at the venue. And normally, like, one radio station kind of takes over. But our afternoon drive team, which was Marconi, who I was interning with, they were up with the morning show from the hip hop station, the Playhouse, which blew my mind because these were like two of the shows that were one of the reasons I got into radio at that time. And then we saw the Executioners up there who were DJs, and watching those guys spin again blew my mind. It was just freaking amazing watching these guys. But the thing that stands out the most of this tour is as I'm walking around hauling stuff back to the stage, back to the car, and all this other stuff, was the protesters. The people who were protesting Eminem because of his lyrics. And how upset they were about his lyrics. And somebody filmed me somewhere. I don't even remember what I said, but they were like, "What do you think of Eminem's lyrics?" And I was like, "They're pretty good. I like them." And they're like, "Well, what do you think about these lyrics?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I enjoyed them. I'm not going to follow through on any of the things he says because I'm a smart human being and I don't need things dumbed down for me. But thanks." Yeah. And it was like this group of these like fucking psychopath hippies, and they're like, "What?" And it's like, "Dude, go fuck yourself! Like, get out of here."
No, it's dude. I wish that I had had the foresight and money to hire people like that to pick it outside my shows, because it's the best publicity you could ever ask for. It's the best publicity. The reason he got as big as he was. He was a genius, is a genius, but he got infamous because of all the protesters. They helped him immensely. He thanked them, and he should.
There was a
They're
rumor.
Very valuable.
There was a rumor that, God, excuse me, I apologize. There was a rumor that his first album was going to be pulled from music shelves. I don't know how that rumor got started, but I can tell you that definitely helped people gobble it up, because I knew a lot of people who were like, They're gonna pull this thing from the music stores. I got to go get it now. And so people made a beeline to the music stores to pick up that CD because they weren't sure if they're going to be able to get it. But yeah, it's just I still remember where I was at the Rose Garden in Portland, Oregon, walking back and forth, and these people just fucking hounding me because I'm working with the radio station. And I was like, dude, get a fucking life. Like, just,
it's so good.
Just go the fuck away, man. So we're going to wrap up now, because this is a perfect tie-in for the beef between Eminem and Limp Bizkit. Because prior to this, we had discussed the song that they did together that never made it on the album. Mm. And the feud all kind of wraps around Everlast, who was the lead singer of House of Pain. They broke up. Mm. He ended up, you know, doing his own thing, which I love. Everlast. I'll listen to his stuff.
His stuff is great. Yeah.
So it all started there. And there was a beef between Eminem and Everlast. So DJ Lethal, who was in House of Pain with Everlast, they had a falling out. And when Eminem and Everlast were kind of trading diss tracks, Durst and Lethal, they were originally willing to be on Eminem's song. They were like, yeah, hey, we'll come be on the song. And they even told him, like, you write the lyrics and we'll do it. Like, essentially, Fred Durst was going to have Eminem write him lyrics and then he was going to rap them on the song. And then they backed out at the last minute. And it was all of a sudden, really? Fred called him up. He's like, hey, I've got a toothache and Lethal's busy. And for Eminem, he's like, no, you guys are pussies. Like, you're backing out of this because for some unknown reason, you guys don't want to go toe-to-toe with Everlast. So that was what that's kind of what got the ball rolling. But what really was the straw that broke the camel's back was when DJ Lethal was on MTV and he made the claim that Everlast could kick Eminem's ass. Seriously. Like, that was really what kind of just toppled that whole thing over.
That's just... But I mean, here's the thing. Does anyone know why they canceled? Was there a moment where, like, Everlast and them...
I haven't really been able to find anything, but again, if people watching this, if you have information that we aren't providing or that maybe I haven't been able to find and you do have an actual source, comment and link below and let us know, because I would love to put that information out there. So I haven't been able to find exactly what it was, but what Eminem claims is Fred was like, I've got a toothache and DJ Lethal's busy. Right.
DJ's busy. Oh, little DJ Lethal.
And again, that's how we got to wrap this up. This is how we got to wrap this episode up, is if you can, go listen to the outro track of Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water, because it is ridiculously funny with Ben Stiller. He's like, yo, I think that's a message you really want out there. It's, you know, cutting your ass raw with a chainsaw. I just want to put it on record.
For everyone who's watching that doesn't know exactly what we mean, because we forget that, you know, you people are... Anyway, go to the last song and then drag the meter thing across on your phone past the silence towards the end of the track, because it's like a 10-minute track, even though the song is only 3. That's called a secret track. So then you don't skip. You have to let the song play out or drag across.
I don't think
across.
There's silence on that one.
No, there is. I since the last time we spoke about it, I looked it up. Yeah, on Spotify, you have to drag across silence? To the silence.
Because because what I remember is it's the beat, the DJ Lethal beat that keeps going.
Oh,
and
shit,
then
you're absolutely right. I'm thinking about. There's more afterwards though. They wind it down, and then there's silence, and then I'm thinking of the other one.
Yeah,
so there's two secret tracks on that.
Yeah, no,
go and listen to all of them.
The Ben Stiller part pops in while that Lethal beat is still going.
You're right. How does he start it again? How does he start it again?
Oh, fuck.
He says, fuck Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, he goes, fuck Limp Bizkit, man. Yeah. And that's when Fred's like, so you don't like us? And he's like, no, I'm limping with the biscuit. I'm totally limping
with the biscuit. Down with the biscuit. Yeah, no, my favorite is when he's like, no, I just love your fucking message, man. Like, fuck you, man. Shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up,
Mom. Big bad rock star. Yeah, big bad rock star. Ooh.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode. We got an encore coming up, so let's just jump right to it. Let's wrap this up.
Right to it.
No, like, this is where you wrap it up.
His I'm kidding. I'm not frozen. I just wanted to see how long I could make it last. For his name is Brandon. He's the DJ.
His name is Shim.
Roll your eyes at me. Just
he's
roll them.
Fuckwad. Rockstar. Class dismissed.
And now we're in the encore.
And now we are into the That's encore. And I have something that I wanted to talk about in the encore, too. There was So, obviously, we've been talking a lot about our social medias, you know, here on these episodes, the remixes and stuff like that. And I did a short on something we've talked about in... I think we first brought it up in Rockstar 101, which is where how Limp Bizkit, the video for Roland got taken off the air because of 9/11, because they filmed it on top of the World Trade Center tower.
Yeah.
So,
So wait, can I ask a question? The video for Limp Bizkit's Rollin' was taken off the air because it was filmed on top of the World Towers.
Yeah.
How long after 9/11 was that video released?
Before?
I misspoke. How long before? How many days before was it? Was it really fresh, or it had been out for like a few weeks?
It had been out actually probably for over a year, because the single was released back in the year 2000. So right. It would have been about 1 year. So it's not like, I don't think it was getting really heavy rotation, but it probably just got yanked. It just got yanked off the air. And so I did a short on that, and it blew the fuck up on Instagram to 56,000 views, I think, in like the span of 2 hours. So I dropped that Sunday, September 11th of this year. And then that Monday morning when I woke up, I get one notification that somebody has tagged me in one of their reels. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, this person just used my audio. And so it's me reading did you know that Limp Bizkit's Rollin' was taken off MTV because of all they did was take the audio. Yeah. And then they put the video for Rollin', and then they put the lyrics or they put text with what I was saying that they got from TikTok. And I saw it and I'm like, okay, so first of all, that's kind of cool. Because somebody's using my shit. Should I be upset because all they did was take my work, slap a video on it, and then have TikTok type out text? Because I sometimes will pronounce a D at end of things sometimes, especially when there's like an N. And it's just, I wouldn't call it a speech impediment, but it's something that happens, or like a G sometimes as well. Right. So that instead of it saying Rollin' in the text, it said Roland, the video for Roland. They had actually messaged me, I think, beforehand. I wasn't quite sure if they had or not. And they were just like, hey, and then they shared it with me. And then I was also like, so should they have asked for permission first? And the more I thought about it, and I was like, who fucking cares? I was like, if these people want to use it and they gave me the credit, I have no problems fucking being like, yeah, cool, man. There's no need for me to be an asshole about it, right?
Are you asking?
I'm asking you. My train of thought now is fucking do it. Now, if it becomes a thing where like you're regularly stealing my shit and you're getting a ton of views off it, okay, we're going to have a problem. But if you wanted to use my thing to kind of help boost your channel a little bit, which they already have more followers on Instagram than I do, but I got no problems whatsoever. If they sent me something like, hey, could you read this like quick 10 second line? I'd probably just fucking do it for free and send it to them.
Right. But when they tagged you in their new upload, right?
Yeah.
So people knew that it was from you, that you were connected to it. So you got, they didn't plagiarize it completely. They said, hey, we like this guy. We did his thing. We've done another version of it. Here's his site.
Yeah. I mean, it was the way that they tagged it, I'm trying to find it here. So they just said a little edit I threw together the other day. It's like, bitch, I spent 2.5 hours on my fucking video. Yeah. And it was like, I didn't want to post it yesterday, but today I'm back with my bullshit. And then at the bottom, he says, thank you to the real Brandalorian for this awesome bit of history and the awesome narration. I'm like, so you gave me the credit right there. You even sent me a message about it.
Well, did he put the link in? He actually put like your at the real Brandalorian. So you're stoked. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how much time did you spend thinking about this?
Almost like not a lot. But I think that's what I've been thinking about more periodically throughout the day is like, should I have given more thought to it? Because my immediate thought was cool. Like I got no problems that those guys did that. Like I got no issues. Yeah. But then later on in the day, today as we're filming this episode, it's been a fucking hellacious day where I've been at it for 14 straight hours now. Like just planning videos and content and doing all of these other things. And it's like, should I have cared more? And my brain keeps going back to, no, it's a fucking 30-second clip about Limp Bizkit.
Yeah. No, I actually dealt with this
at the beginning when I and I'll tell you the reason that it's awesome. I'll tell you the reason and I'll explain it. And the first thing is, it's awesome not just because, hey, that's nice. It's awesome because you are starting to create things that people consider to be relevant. They would not have done that if they didn't consider it to be relevant. And relevant is very cool, if because that's what you ultimately want. When you don't want to create things that are irrelevant, you want to create things that are relevant. And then you want them to be good and to be successful and all the other stuff. But you, there's a difference. If you have something that gets a million views that's irrelevant, you get left with a feeling of like, well, I got these numbers and stuff, but no one's coming back a second time because my shit's not relevant. It's different when people are actually taking the time to copy it and paste it and go, oh, this has some meaning. This impinges an emotional reaction and I want to share it, which is why everyone says the best content is the most shareable content. I had the same thing come up. It was a little bit different where I remember I didn't care about it. We were doing shows, we were touring all the time. People would come up and wait outside the bus with photos that they'd printed out. And they would wait for like an hour or two outside the bus and we'd wake up and we'd go, oh, we're at the club, go out, sign some pictures. And then there'd always be these guys in the middle of nowhere that would actually travel around the state. And they would have these envelopes with really perfectly printed out things and they would make you sign it in a blue pen. And they would insist that you sign it with a blue pen. And I didn't really think about it. And then someone was like, oh, yeah, because those guys are selling it on eBay. They sell them. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then I kept signing them. I'm like, oh, they're signing, whatever. Like, he wants me to say, it takes 1 second, whatever. It's a compliment. You think my shit's relevant enough that my little fucking signature on this piece of plastic with my face on it is going to make money? Then one of the radio reps walked us off the bus to go do radio. And we did it. And as we're walking away, he said to me, doesn't that fucking just make you insanely angry? And I was like, why? And he broke it down. And he said, you've spent 10 years, 15 years writing songs, developing craft, going into debt, flying to the States, making the demos, getting on tour, missing your family, getting sick, doing all of it. And they're the ones profiting off it. They just print out a picture and get you to sign it and they go and make the money. The only reason that piece of picture, the only reason that piece of paper is valuable is because your face and signature's on it. They're monetizing your work. And I was immediately enraged because I was like, you're fucking right. That's totally true. And I wound myself up for ages thinking about it, to the point where when we were at the Nickelback tour in Canada, I'll never forget it. We went for a walk around the arena. And outside the arena, there was these two middle-aged Asian guys. Don't know what nationality they were. The only reason that it's relevant that they were Asian is because they spoke broken English. English was their second language. And they had images, very well printed out images that of Nickelback, Shinedown, Breaking Benjamin, and us. And they were selling them as if they were official merch, but they were outside the walls of the arena. And I was just going for a walk, and I went up, and I saw it, and they're charging like $25 for these laminated pictures. And I'm fucking enraged. So I look at him and I'm like, nice picture. Really nice. He said, yes, very nice. Very nice. You like 25? And I said, no. And I pointed at my face and I went, nice picture. I pointed at my face and then pointed at my head. I'm like, nice picture, huh? And he went, yes, very nice. You like? And I said, no, that's
me.
And I pointed, I said, that's me. And he said, yes, you have 25. And I said, no, that's my face. It took me ages to finally go, you aren't allowed to do this. And I was trying to communicate to go, here's why I'm upset and look at what you're, and I picked it up and pointed and I was like, that's me. This is my, I had to spell it out for
this
guy.
Did you ever hold the picture up like this?
Yeah, I had to hold it up and go like this. I said, that's my band. I'm playing in there. You're not allowed to do this. This is my money, my face, my work. And he went, yes, very good, $15.
Well, hey, you got the lead singer discount, man.
No, what I actually did was get him shut down. I actually got them to pack up. I didn't go call security. I just literally, I was a dick. I was a dick, hand to God. I said to everyone walking past, I was like, yo, these guys aren't official, man. If you like our bands, go and buy a t-shirt. Don't give these guys your money. And they were like, oh, no, it's okay. And then eventually they got embarrassed, packed up and left. And I felt proud of myself
And after a while, I realized they're going to be back the next day doing it. This is their hustle. This is what they do.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whose face is on that piece of plastic or paper. They're just trying to make their living. It's never going to stop. And I realized I got myself worked up. I had this big rush of adrenaline and then a drop in fucking like anxiety of like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen next. And it was all me. And I realized I just got to let all of this shit go because they're going to do it anyway. If that kid had copied your video and not given you credit, there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter. Well, so you may as well take it as a compliment.
Well, yeah. And even then, like they did, they sent it to me. They messaged me.
That's all nice.
Tagged me, which was you know, I like, and it's don't coincidentally, have to do enough, any well, I'm, of I'll, that. Shit, I'll give them a plug right here on the podcast. So it's Fire for Effect Candle Company. You can find them on Instagram. It's FFE_candle_co. It's like CO. So go give them a follow, man. I mean, I got no problem sharing the love. If they want to use my stuff, it's fine. Just don't overdo it because I do put a ridiculous amount, like Shim can attest to this, I'd put a ridiculous amount of time and effort into the shit that I'm doing.
And that's why they're working, because they're fucking good.
And I mean, I'm also a firm believer that being nice goes a lot further than being an asshole. Different, vastly different scenarios. These guys aren't taking money out of my pocket. Those people were. They were taking money out of your pocket because they were selling merch that was unlicensed merchandise, and that's a major problem. Yeah. This was just somebody who liked something that I did, and they used my voice, which for some reason I got a continual frog in my throat through this whole episode. And I got no problems. You know, it's like they, like I said, they have more followers on Instagram than I do. So really, what am I doing for them other than the fact that they're doing more for me essentially at that point. But really quick here, before we wrap up this, this episode, it brought me back to when you were talking about the whole signature thing and how those guys would just do that. And something I always thought that would be cool, but also could be considered a dick move, is if I were to make it famous, I don't sign anything. Like, you don't sign something because, you know, I would, and this is how weird my brain works. You would watch Pawn Stars and they're like, yeah, this one's not worth that much because this guy signed a million fucking things and everybody's got this guy's autograph. Or it's like, there's almost no official copies of this guy's autograph. So it's worth a shit ton of money. So it's like, well, so if I don't sign anything and I do make it famous, then I shouldn't sign stuff. Which immediately took me to a story with Morgan Freeman. I don't know if he just, it's a rule of his or if it was just that night, but when we were about 19 years old, we're all hanging out downtown Portland, and all of a sudden I hear one of my friends go, "Holy shit, it's Morgan Freeman!" Who I believe at that time had a house in Portland, I think. And everybody kind of like, "What? What?" And so, sure as shit, there's Morgan Freeman just walking down the sidewalk. So one of our friends is like, give me a fucking pen. And so everybody had their cars parked right out there on Broadway because we were those assholes. And so people are like digging through their glove box looking for pens and stuff. So he goes up there, you know, with like, my notepad, like, here's the pen. And they ask him to sign it. And he just looks at them. I'm not even going to try to do a Morgan Freeman voice at Mike Patel. I would try, and it would be funny because it's shitty, but my voice is going out. And he just looked at him, and he goes, because the kid asked him if he would sign the piece of paper. And Morgan Freeman says, "No, but you can shake my hand." And the kid came back fucking pissed. He's like, "That motherfucker wouldn't sign. He just said I could sit there and shake his hand." And I was like, "Did you shake his hand? I would have." He's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "That's Morgan Freeman. Like, you go shake his hand, man."
He didn't shake his hand. He just walked off pissed.
No, he did. He did. He said that he did shake his hand. Except it was kind of like, okay, cool. Hey, thanks. It's like, it's fucking Morgan Freeman, man. That dude could have been like, "You can kiss my hand." I'd be like, fucking cool. Done.
Morgan Freeman. Man. Nah, that goes well. I like it. So that is so Morgan Freeman to say that, isn't it?
Yeah.
To say, "No, son, but you can shake my hand," or however he fucking talks. But like,
"With my friend Andy, I told him he could shake my hand."
But like, yeah, and it is fair enough. It'd be like, you don't sign autographs because you value your autograph and your signature and all that sort of stuff. It'd be like, yo, how about we have a human interaction for a second? Morgan Freeman's time is valuable.
Yeah.
For him to say, yeah, you could, I love Morgan Freeman. One of my goals is to write an opening sort of poem thing for an album and have Morgan Freeman say it and have him open one of my albums. Wouldn't that be cool?
You know what's going to end up happening, yeah. Right?
What?
You're going to get one of those guys that does a, like Frank Caliendo that does a Morgan Freeman impression. That's what you're going
to
get.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. And then I'll get everyone else in Hollywood to do a version of it as Christopher Walken. You know.
Who could you get for that? Jay Moore, I know, does a really good
all of them. Christopher everyone Walken. Does it. Yeah, but he does a really good one.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up. Let's call it good. And we'll just do this and say goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone. All right.
Bye-bye.